Hello, listener. This is an episode of The Lit Pickers, and my co-host Dipanjana and myself, Supriya, are in a studio in the city of Bombay, and our producers have just told us to say that we're in the mood for love.
I mean, if Tony Long will show up, yes, anytime, yeah. All the time. Otherwise, I'm having a really hard time keeping a straight face. But also, Supriya, you of the bedroom voice, how are you not saying in the mood for love? Not like that.
Because life is not only not a Wong Kar-wai movie, it is also not a New Jeans video, Dipanjana. As we have learned over the last few years. However, there is a reason for the season, or this is the season for the reason for this episode, if you like. And so, because this is dropping just around Valentine's Day, and we've heard that this is a big deal for some of you, we thought we would make this episode about fictional characters we love.
Or at least crush on desperately.
Yeah.
Love seems the love like is a romantic. Lot of commitment.
That's true. And as literature itself has taught us, there are a lot of different kinds of love.
This is true.
And since Valentine's Day is specifically about
a romance.
Yeah. We'll do our best to try
we'll
and
do
hew
our best
as close to
not
that.
Be the cynics that we are.
Yeah, even though, you know, for us, our hearts are, you know, of many shades and
mostly a
delicate
dark
hues.
Shade of black in my case. But if you're in the mood for more cynicism than we're dishing out today, we did do a whole episode, slightly drunk, called The Literary Bro Code, which was supposed to be about fictional men that we like, well, crush on, and then it just turned into something else. It's great fun. It's very mead-leaden.
There was also so much mead that I actually can't remember who I brought up in that episode.
I have actually heard that episode multiple times because it's really fun. So I will steer us away from repeats.
Dipanjana of the honeyed mead voice.
It was actually you, but yes.
Can you tell
I'll
us,
take it.
Can you tell us what the frame for this episode is before we jump into it?
So entirely randomly, you and I decided that we are going to cover a spectrum. In more ways than one.
An age range, if you will, and which is also a different kinds of things range.
So the challenge that we have set for ourselves is to talk about fictional crushes that Supriya has had before the age of 20 and that I have had after the age of 40. The years in between are a vast wasteland of experience.
That is absolutely not the truth, but to know the truth... We'll have some kind of ticketed Lit Pickers event, which will be sponsored
truth,
by some kind of champagne
firm.
Us
in person.
I feel like one of the things you'll see with this particular demographic spread is also the difference between how we think about love and romance when we are in our salad days and how we think about it when we are in our fruit salad days. Let me kick this off by, in fact, bringing you a question that I think you will love answering. Mm. And in fact, that I think you're better qualified to talk about than I am. Why do you think so many of us love Karna from the Mahabharata?
Mm.
In a kind of almost very modern sense.
That's a fascinating question. And I love that you've decided to kick off our crush episode with the story of a young man who was born out of a crush.
Mm.
Okay, so for those who may not know the backstory for Karna, Karna is Kunti's first son.
Mm-hmm.
She has him with the god of the sun, who is effectively her first crush.
Because who among us, right, hasn't looked up at the blue sky and gone, yep.
Apparently not enough of us. But anyway, so the sun god is known for having been a hottie in our Hindu pantheon.
But I'm... Tsh-
And Kunti is given as a reward for some work that she's done, a mantra that allows her to summon any being that she wants, divine or otherwise. Nobody tells her, apparently, that summoning is also to biblically know that person. I am mixing epics here, but understand
yes.
In a PG-13 way what I mean. So she uses the mantra, the sun god shows up, and bada bing, bada boom, she has a baby. Technically, he's not a Pandav because obviously his paternity is not part of the Pandu set
line.
He is, however, Kunti's son. He's also an extremely proud and able warrior who, unlike the Pandavs, actually grows up in a pretty happy family setup from what we know. Later on in the story, Karna is very clear that his loyalties lie with Duryodhan because Duryodhan has treated him with respect as opposed to much of the other Kshatriya community. who treat him very badly for being a charioteer's son.
Right.
Because he's been adopted by a charioteer. Mm. Kunti has the son and then, much like Moses,
gives him away to the river, as it were.
And this charioteer picks him up. Karna's other name is Radheya because his mother's name is Radha. He's a much more dynamic character than most heroes get to be because he is very heroic. He has choices that leave you conflicted, I think. But at every situation, aside from seeming extremely hot, he makes terrible situations incredibly dignified with his behavior.
I think for those for whom epics are primarily the source of religious stories or who perhaps are familiar with one dimension of them, it seems like in all our classics from cultures around the world, life is very simple and that they're about moral lessons about what is good and what is evil. And there is an aspect of that to many of the classics that we have inherited, including the Mahabharata. But I think Karna is probably many people's initial acquaintance with the idea. And, you know, the funny thing is it remains an idea, right, until life teaches you otherwise, which is that sometimes you can be good and you can be a hero and there's still no victory for you.
Yeah.
Of course, none of this meant anything to 4-year-old me, you know, along with Imran Khan, cricketer Imran Khan.
We must specify.
The tragic heroic story of Karna, who was in the right and who was good and who was a hero, but who nonetheless had to fall by the logic of the story, was maybe my first understanding of what a crush is.
Also, something that I think makes Karna very, very sexy is how much of the world, divine and temporal, has to come together to bring him down. The gods come to take his gifts away. His mother comes asking him to not fight against her other sons. Everybody comes and says to him, you know, be smaller, contain yourself so that we can be what we want to be. And he's always like, you know what? I will do what is right and I'm not looking for the consequences. There's something so very, very sexy about that.
Very attractive about that.
So that was 4-year-old Supriya, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, you are very, very intellectual as a 4-year-old.
I mean, look, I'm still holding out hope for Imran Khan.
Really?
Even though that may get me on a no-fly list in this country.
I can't take him seriously anymore. I mean, it was hard to take him seriously even in the 80s when he was posing for these spreads that had, like, I don't know, tigers in the background. And
hair on his chest.
Yes! I'm okay with the hair on the chest, but it was like, it was so 80s. His hair was blow-dried. There was gold glinting out of his chest.
Yes, well, I was born in the 80s. You know, these things were fashionable to me at the time. And, of course, he was known as Im the Dim, famously.
Im the Dim. I love that
even
nickname.
Before.
Yeah.
One can't hold these things against.
No, people. One must not. One must celebrate them.
One must celebrate dimbos.
Okay, when it comes to dimbos, I think, and I will get so much hate from the K-drama community for this, but I think my favorite dimbo remains Chaunu in Rookie Historian Guhairam.
Who on earth? I will fight anyone who objects to Chaunu. In Rookie Historian or indeed anywhere else.
Yeah, no, he's lovely.
I firmly believe in the supremacy of Chaunu.
And I love that his entire career is basically dimbo characters. I'm here for it. But Rookie Historian was a particularly special feeling for me.
For those who know nothing about Korean television, this show is special to us. It was the first one I ever watched and a very early one that Dipanjana watched. And it makes sense for us to talk about it on The Lit because even though, you know, this is our podcast and we can talk about whatever we want, because it is very deeply and profoundly about literary culture, about writing, about storytelling and about history.
Yeah. The central point of the K-drama Rookie Historian Guhairang is literally how women claim a narrative and create a narrative. As wonderful as Shin Se-kyung is as Guhairang, my gaze could not help but be ensnared by the poreless, glowing beauty of A. Chaunu, but also the guy who played his elder brother, Park Ki-young.
Right.
Now, Park Ki-young has not really been seen in anything before or after.
But he plays an idealist intellectual who is dearly beloved of our himbo hero, who is an idealist dimbo.
So here's the thing. Park Ki-young plays Crown Prince Yi-jin, who is, like you said, idealist, but he's also trapped in a very unhappy marriage because he can't trust his wife. He falls in love with one of the secondary lead kind of characters and the love story between those two, which has nothing except for conversation and just smoldering glances and books.
Mm.
They give each other stories to read and they share stories. They spend,
and they like different things
to
read and to write and think
about.
They
spend a whole night just talking about stories. How do you not fall in love with a guy
and
like that?
It brings down the politics of the palace. Like we learned as we went along in our adventures watching Korean entertainment, these shows are very often not afraid of intellectualism in the slightest. Mm. And this was a great introduction. Hard not to fall for everyone
in
on that,
that
show.
Yeah, yeah. This is something that I've enjoyed over the years, right? When it comes to crushing, it's always more fun to crush on the supporting character in a story, I feel.
Can you explain the logic for people who are listening to this who have possibly never read a book?
Or seen a story? I think for me, the fun of it is that I get to imagine stuff. The story gives you a few key points which you latch onto, but those are points and possibilities.
Mm.
And it falls upon your imagination to place this character in different situations and fall in love with them again and again. Whereas with the main character, everything is quite clearly delineated. And
right,
so
it
you
is
know.
About their trajectory.
Yeah.
So unless you really want to veer them off their path,
which is,
sometimes people do.
God bless fan fiction.
Yes.
But, you know, supporting characters, I feel, become far more interesting. I mean, I think in many ways, that's exactly what Maniratnam did with Pony and Selvan. If you've heard our episode, and if you have not, please do hear it. It's a great conversation with Anand Krishnamurti, who did the sound for the film. But we talk a little bit about how the films are basically Maniratnam doing fan fiction.
Right, because he elevates characters who are more marginal in the books and brings
exactly.
them to center stage. You know, this got me looking through my list to see if there were any supporting characters in my romantic purview before I turned 20. And I have to say no, but also let me say this quickly.
Hmm.
Julian from The Famous Five, which of course, you know, when you're like a studious, two pigtails, school prefect running type, of course you like Julian.
Yeah.
I make no bones about it. You know, this is what I was. I was a prig as a child and I loved other prigs. But I also realized that if I were to go back to The Famous Five now, my crush would actually be Uncle Quentin. He's like a hot, absent-minded scientist who just lets his kids run riot on some island that he owns.
No explanations needed. Please just do your
thing. Has a cute dog.
Yep.
But you know, most people, they'll make a Famous Five for people who like Julian.
Yes. And Julian is written, like so many boy characters were for children's fiction, as a PG-13 thirst trap.
Yes, very much a PG-13.
You know, he's written to evoke feelings.
It's true. I mean, I suppose there's also the sweet naughtiness of his younger brother, Dick, who I believe is called Rick in,
because
in new editions. Losers.
It's just made it worse because like now you will see that name with only penile associations.
But they should do a Famous Five adaptation
so that we can
get a trans George.
Oh,
I think that would be really
cool. That would be
so good. Uncle Quentin, hot dad who supports his trans son.
Yeah. On an island with a dog. Great. What is
doing science?
How are
and
they
not that I care about science, I have to tell you guys, I don't know anything about it, but is water wet? But anyway, is there a scientist character in your post-40 list? Or an intellectual of any sort?
See, the thing is,
after
science
Eugene?
Just usually turns me off. Especially the way it's sort of, you know, pitted as this intellectual, smart, masculine thing that people do.
We're tired of STEM discourse.
Yeah, really, don't care. Bring more women into it and then maybe I'll find it sexier. But I was just thinking that I wish when I was growing up and, you know, reading my way through Blyton's complete works, I wish there had been a character like Alex Fierro, who's from the Rick Riordan universe. He wrote a series with the central character of Magnus Chase, and this is based on Norse mythology. Alex Fierro is a child of Loki, and more emphatically gender fluid than any character that I have read since Orlando.
So they are Loki's son, but they are high-key non-binary. Am I right about
that? Loki's child and high-key non-binary.
Right.
Yes.
All right.
And Alex Fierro is delicious. Alex Fierro also ends up being Magnus Chase's love interest.
Love interest.
Which was wonderful.
Huge.
The kiss between those two, oh my heart. I mean, full anticipation and joy. But also, like, Alex Fierro is great because they're not a comfortable character, right? They're angry. They've got a lot of pain.
Well, if you were Loki's child,
first of all.
Yeah. You would be also pressed.
Yes, you would be pressed. You need to know your Norse mythology to get that pun. But Alex says at one point that I'm not here to teach you and I'm not your poster child. I am working my stuff out. It falls on you to educate yourself.
Right. I'm working on myself.
Like
I'm going, I'm going to the gym. I go to anti-gravity.
In case,
I go to the CCI gym. In I case get a massage. Of, I do yoga.
In case of Alex, Alex turns into a number of animals, devastates their training gym, and also decapitates Magnus in the process of working on themselves.
So they kill their lover. Nothing could be better.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm so into it.
It's a great character. But I mean, unfortunately, I found Alex, I think, in my 30s. Definitely not in my 40s. I would have loved to have had Alex when I was growing up, though. Just because irrespective of how you identify as a person individually, these kinds of characters open your world. And that's ultimately what crushes are all about, right? Like, we fall for things that we did not realize turn us on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very far from 20 now. And I have experienced sort of the collapsing of margins around love and romance and attraction as a function of growing older, of realizing that these things can be complicated and that, you know, the things you're conditioned to like in people who present as men and the things that you're conditioned to value in people who present as women, these can sometimes mix and you want different things out of romance, regardless of what your sexual preference or gender preference may be.
And I'm reminded at this point, possibly because we've been talking about gender fluid characters, of the person that Virginia Woolf's Orlando ultimately is with in the novel.
Yes.
Orlando, the novel, for those of you who aren't aware of it, is one of the first, I guess, examples of gender fluid heroine.
Easily the first modern, like intentionally gender fluid examples from the 20th century.
Yeah. And it's a book that has a lot of people feeling many feelings, some negative, some positive. You should always read these books for yourself to find out what you will find yourself.
You can also hear us talking about it on an earlier episode of The Lit Pickers, the first Read Like a Girl that we did now in the deeps of time. But you can fish it up because the internet is forever.
Orlando is a beloved book for me. It's also just at a level of language so beautifully written, but also the ideas in it are fabulous. And Orlando's final partner is Marmaduke Bonthrop Shelmadine. Great name, first of all.
First of all.
The idea of a name is very interestingly sort of teased out, right? Because the book says that I think they're Mar when Orlando feels dreamy, Shell when they feel nothing, and Bonthrop when Orlando's in a solitary mood. And Shell is what you hear them being referred to as most of the time. Shell is distinctly non-binary. Strange and vulnerable as a woman, and something about being very outspoken like a man. Seems feminine, but is masculine, is a sailor, comes in with the right direction of the wind. The sexiest part about Shell is that Shell and Orlando together feel free.
Shorlando.
Forever.
Shorlando! It's very hard to sometimes bring together, you know, the fizz and fun of attraction and, again, the things that we're conditioned to like with the things that really liberate us in love.
Yeah.
But Virginia Woolf, I guess, understood how to do both those things. Mm. This question of gender fluidity and, you know, what it means to us as we're growing up and what it means perhaps to the people who are growing up now, I realize that there are overlaps between these things because you find unusual, uncommon gender presentation everywhere when you look, right? Particularly in the classics. And while you were speaking, I remembered my favorite character from The Arabian Nights, which is a set of stories I loved as a child. Who doesn't? Who's Zumurrud from Alishar and Zumurrud. Do you remember the story?
I
tell you?
Yes, please.
Alishar is the most useless man in Khorasan.
Okay.
Everybody knows it. He inherits an enormous amount of wealth from his father. And he's walking through the market of Khorasan once and he sees a slave auction. And the most beautiful woman in the world is on the dock. And people are, you know, shouting out, trying to buy her, and she spurns them and mocks them. And she sees Alishar. And this is where you know that love is not rational. Because this amazingly beautiful, smart woman who, you know, retains her independence even though she's on the dock and wants to choose her own master points to Alishar when she sees him passing by. Okay, he's not even there to buy. She points to him and she says, that's going to be my master. And so Alishar brings her home. They fall in love. They get married. He has frittered away his father's wealth. So Zumurrud makes these astonishing, magically beautiful curtains. And she gives them to Alishar to sell. And so they become wealthy. But then, you know, one of the men who wanted to buy Zumurrud swoops in and attacks because he still covets her. And of course, Alishar is the one who gets into trouble because of all of this, right?
Right.
His life is over. He's destroyed, scattered, you know, whatever. We think he's dead, maybe. Zumurrud escapes, disguises herself as a man, and flees far to a city where the king has just died and where the custom is the first stranger who comes at the gates becomes the new king. So Zumurrud, dressed as a man, becomes the king and rules the city. And, you know, the city prospers because Zumurrud is so smart and amazing and gorgeous. And people keep bringing her brides because the king must marry and have a family. But instead of all of that, she brings the people who ruined her life to justice. And, you know, she executes Barzum, the lustful slave trader, whatever. And then finally, when Alishar comes before her, she reveals herself to him and they get reunited.
It's a happy day ever.
It's so lovely. And, you know, looking back, Zumurrud was definitely one of my first literary crushes.
Oh,
how can you not love a woman like this?
Yeah.
She's got it all. And she makes great curtains. Unbeatable.
Listen, it is so important to have a practical skill. Like, it's all very well to be beautiful, talented, magical, but
great at ruling kingdoms.
Soft furnishings. That is a proper asset.
That's where it's at.
I want to bring in the two characters that I did not anticipate I would fall as close to writing fan fiction as I have felt in recent times.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about this. Is it who I think they are?
No, probably not.
Okay.
But we can get to the ones that you think in a bit. I was going to talk about Alabaster and Essun, who are two characters from the Broken Earth trilogy by N.K. Jemisin.
Essun is the narrator, right?
Essun is...
I've read the first book.
Yeah. So the idea central to the Broken Earth trilogy is that the planet is about to basically collapse into itself. The various forces, elemental natural forces, are very much at war, and there are certain people called the Orogenes who can control these forces to some extent. The most powerful of them is a dark man called Alabaster, so that in itself, yay. Alabaster is an older man. He's saturnine, he's difficult, he's forced to take on a lover because these powers should not disappear with him. He should have a child.
Right.
He's not particularly interested in any of these things. Essun, on the other hand, yes, protagonist. She has been a mother who has seen her children being killed for the powers that she and they possessed. All of this happens very early on. No spoilers at all, but essentially, these are two central characters who have very differing arcs towards finding their reasons to continue in a world that seems to be coming to an end. I loved how powerful they were in face of, again, a bit like Karna, everything goes wrong. And these two are just like, this is what I have to do. I will do it. Essun is unlike any of the simpering maternal constructs that have become so popular, like the sort of rose-tinted softness, femininity. There's very little softness in Essun.
She's hard as rock.
Yeah, but also as reliable as rock.
Yes.
You know, like femininity as something that is granite-like, Essun gives you that sense of it. She protects those who need protection. She grieves those who demand grieving. And she spills blood when blood needs to be spilled. It's a sexy-ass, crackling character. And in a world that is so bleak, it's a great reminder. Alabaster, Essun, these characters sort of, they remind you of how much we repose by way of faith and affection in individuals. When everything's going to hell, we turn to people. We don't only turn to ideas. Those ideas need to take a form for us to feel hope.
And that form has to be...
ideally, you know,
human.
Yeah.
Or
human presenting at any rate.
You know, among all my friends who regularly read science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction, this Broken Earth trilogy has really made its way into their hearts.
It's so well done.
Yeah. Is it more extraordinary than many other things you've read in recent SF history?
N.K. Jemisin and Ursula Le Guin are top of my list. Mm. And for anyone to come close to Le Guin,
me, is a big deal.
Is a huge achievement.
Absolutely.
And honestly, not in her other stuff. I went on a binge after reading the Broken Earth trilogy. And it's not like she's not an accomplished writer. She's very good at writing whatever she chooses to write.
Yeah.
But Broken Earth trilogy is just special.
I read her first book, which I've forgotten the title of, and I feel like I admired it without falling in love with it.
Yeah, that's how I felt about most of the other stuff that I read of N.K. Jemisin's. Broken Earth trilogy, though, and particularly the first book, I felt like my pulse was moving to the earthquakes that are making this world fall apart. It was incredible.
Fabulous. Okay, to continue on the run of talking about extraordinary women and female presenting characters. Hmm. Have you read The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins?
Yes.
I think for any listeners who aren't particularly acquainted with 19th century English fiction, which can be kind of daunting, right? Because it feels like the basis of so much that literature girls talk about. You could do much worse than simply start and maybe end with The Woman in White, which is just an unhinged ghost story, you know, that is about like murder, it's about intrigue, it's about mental illness, but in the most entertaining way possible. And the heart of it is really about Wilkie Collins's crush on George Eliot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which is why The Woman in White contains an extraordinary character called Marion Halcombe. You only meet her halfway into the novel because she's not the person that the Wilkie Collins stand-in character is going to marry. Indeed, Marion is the formidable, intelligent woman that the incredibly sexy, formidable villain falls in love with and is obsessed with. But she is the moral center of the story, and she's very key to resolving the conflicts and the mystery that The Woman in White is about. I will never forget the way Wilkie Collins introduces her, okay? He talks about you seeing a woman by the window, and she has this exceptional figure. She carries herself with so much grace and she's practically beringed with light. And then she turns and you see that she has a spectacularly ugly face. And that is the phenomenon that was George Eliot in late 19th century England. Eliot was among the foremost intellectuals of her day, brilliant writer, incredibly successful, broke all the rules of love, by the way. And had a radical romantic relationship where she lived without marriage. Shocking Victorian society. And very famously, she was considered an ugly woman.
She was considered ugly in her time.
Yeah.
Which, when you sort of look at her imagery now and look at what people are writing about her in her time, you can see that ugly is the last word to use, right?
I mean, God, that woman had so many people who were crazy about her. After the great love of her life passed away, some guy who was 30 years younger pestered her until until she married him, you know, because people were that crazy about her.
Yeah, she's one of those.
Don't ever let Instagram face let you think that conventional beauty and a sharp chin or how you look from like a top angle have anything to do with how sexy a person is.
Absolutely. But tell me something. Do you feel like in your salad days of pre-20 years, do you think you found yourself gravitating more towards the good characters? And did that change later or not so much?
I've always gravitated towards goody two-shoes characters because I feel like their transformations are the most interesting. Mm. They're often the ones with their backs to the walls, and they're often the followers, the disciples, the supporters. And so in that sense, they're sometimes an audience stand-in character, right? Mm. They're the people who are witness to some kind of brilliance.
Yeah.
And I love that and I really enjoy that and I feel a lot of sympathy for that kind of figure. Mm. So more often than not, good characters matter to me. Mm-hmm. However, very early on in my life, I started to find villains sexy and that never went away.
Yeah. And I found that's been a continued thing. Like even now, for me, one of the most charming fictional characters is, I've forgotten the name of the character, but Peter O'Toole in How to Steal a Million. There is no literary connect to this whatsoever, aside from it just being the most darling film you will ever find.
And well, you know, Peter O'Toole was Lawrence of Arabia, and Lawrence of Arabia wrote Seven Pillars of Wisdom. That's a book. You can go and read it. It's very racist. But,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, there's a great...
Imagine me striking a match and the sunset falling.
Well, Peter O'Toole's bar fights, because he was famous for getting drunk and brawling.
My God.
They're the subject of a book. And I remember reading it and I was thinking, what I would give to be in that bar. But How to Steal a Million, he plays a guy that Audrey Hepburn thinks is a thief. A petty thief. And it's so good. He's not actually a petty thief, as we find out, but he is, for the purposes of the film, a thief. So he does bad things, and he does successfully carry off a fabulous art heist from the Louvre. It is so good.
Peter O'Toole stealing shit from the Louvre is just Europe's finest star.
One of the opening shots of the film, early on, you see just this gilded border and a Van Gogh. So he's holding this thing and the blue of Van Gogh and just above it, his blue eyes. And I was like, oh my God, stop.
Somebody understood art back then.
The whole painting does not need to be there, just the sky and his eyes.
Who has the most compelling eyes in contemporary cinema? Tony Leung, I guess.
Cillian Murphy? But Tony Leung.
Okay, I respect
just
your opinion. I don't know enough about Cillian Murphy to feel moved by his
genuinely
eyes.
I mean,
but I've seen that Oppenheimer still. Yeah, it's very good. That still photo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good.
Tony Leung. Can we take a moment to talk about Tony Leung?
Just eyes that do it all.
What was your first Tony Leung encounter?
Chongqing Express. Mm. And that was before I turned 20, actually.
Oh, there you go.
So, yes, yeah, you can't recover. Oof. There's no coming back from that. I've seen a lot of his work. I have to say the Wong Kar-wai stuff is up there because everything else is part of, you know, Hong Kong cinema, like popular Hindi cinema, just largely like joyous trash, right?
Yeah.
And so I've seen Tony Leung play everything from a cop who's called Bossy by his two simpering female assistants to a guy who plays a supporting character in a Jackie Chan film, which I think is called Gorgeous, where he's a gay man with possibly a crush on Jackie Chan, which would be great if Jackie Chan IRL was not
a homophobe.
Yeah, and a disgusting homophobe.
You know, just the way Wong Kar-wai makes the camera linger with his movements in The Mood for Love, like that is his contribution to humanity. And we will thank Wong Kar-wai and Tony Leung and everyone involved in that film forever after. Like just what you can do with one look and stillness. Oh, I mean, those moments when he and Maggie Cheung are going past each other, having picked up noodles from the alley. I mean, the silence is just crackling with sensuality.
I have to tell all my listeners here now that Dipanjana is currently dressed in a perfectly fitted chongsam.
Sorry. That was not the reaction that would have fired loins, as it were. Okay.
So cinema is about eyes and faces and bodies. And I'm just really glad we got to talk about the best of them on this episode of this very serious podcast about books. How further should we sacrilege this episode?
As much as we feel like it.
Go on.
I want to know, what is your last literary crush from
before
the
Before
you turn 21.
Before I turn 21.
Yeah.
I have a characteristically juvenile answer to that question. Through my childhood and my teenage years, I casually despised P.G. Woodhouse.
Oh.
Because everybody else
loved him
so much.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what is this? I'm different. I'm not like other girls. This is how I felt about Leonardo DiCaprio as well, by the way. So it's just a thing. Hmm. I was like, if it's popular, it's probably not good. I mean, first of all, the Woodhouse canon is kind of up and down. Mm-hmm. But just before I said goodbye to childhood forever, I found what I think had been waiting for me all along, which was Woodhouse's Smith stories.
Oh. They're great.
Smith is not as famous as Jeeves and Wooster or some of Woodhouse's other works. I also think that the Smith books are perhaps not particularly adaptable. I mean, that's a problem people have with Woodhouse anyway because of the language. But they are among Woodhouse's most uncomplicatedly delightful stories. They're just about a lovable scamp called Smith, whose name is spelled with a P at the beginning, and his bestie, Mike, with whom he goes to boarding school and then with whom he kind of grows up and becomes an adult and gets into all kinds of scrapes with. This was truly my understanding of what could make an absolute bastard just so much fun. And I'm very grateful that I had that. And I do think of that as like my last childish love, but one that's grown with me and that, you know, after all these years is something I still look back to very fondly.
Woodhouse is one of those writers, along with Douglas Adams, who I will regularly just read fragments of because they make me feel happy.
They make you laugh.
They're just so funny and so ridiculous. They're irreverent in a way that humor at its best is just, you know, capable of sort of bringing down edifices with just silliness. That's what these two guys can do.
Silliness is the pinnacle of literature. Yeah. It is the icing on top of the cake. I think it's the thing that makes life worth living.
100%. This is why funny men get to be so important in popular discourse and become so easily beloved of audiences. Mm. Because we repose our hope in that silliness. We know how powerful it is.
Did you have a gateway crush into the 40s?
I did. I just realized when you were talking about Smith that I did have a gateway crush because I read this series of books right after I turned 40. And it made me realize something much later, once I'd finished the books, when I had realized that I was headlong in love with this character, that in the 20s and in my salad days, I think when I was crushing on characters, I was mostly looking at things outside, like what I wanted to see in other people. And post being of a certain age, I feel like I fall in love with people that I wish I could be like. And in the process of reading them and loving them, I hope a little bit of them
assimilates into you,
sponges into me, as it were. And the character I'm thinking of is Lady Trent from the Lady Trent series by Mary Brennan. She's a dragon historian and a naturalist.
Mm. Is her Christian name Isabella?
Isabella Trent. Mm. Isabella Camhurst,
she's a crush in law for me because we've spoken about her before.
We've spoken about her before. She was my anchor through the first part of the pandemic. But I had read the first book before and then sort of, you know, not got into the others because you just, it's like love. You need to find yourself and the book and the character at the right time. And Isabella Trent is all kinds of delightful, right? She's not trying to change the world, but she changes the world anyway, all because of her determination to not lose sight of her values, her curiosity, and her grace. How not to love that? Also, there are dragons. And there's a very hot little romance in one of the later books.
I may be biased here, but I do feel that some of what you were talking about earlier, which is about wanting to be like someone, may unconsciously be about the fact that you're drawn to people who mirror you. And as you were speaking about Isabella Trent, I thought, sounds like my friend Dipanjana now.
Aw, on that absolutely marshmallow note.
This is me throwing up finger hearts in the studio.
And me throwing them right back at you. This was the Lit Pickers, a podcast on books and reading with Supriya and Dipanjana.
And we are here to bid you goodbye and wish you luck in your romantic and other endeavors now and always. Bye.
The Lit Pickers is a Made in India production. Don't forget to rate and review and follow or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, tell everyone you know about the show. Share it on social media, tell your friends and family, scream about it on your rooftop. It really helps get the word out. Oh, and use the hashtag LitPickers. Follow Supriya and Dipanjana on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find all of the books they've mentioned or recommended in an online resource via a link in our episode description. Thanks. Keep listening.